The unofficial end to summer is here. School has started for most, football season is upon us, and soon, the leaves will be changing color. At the DSR Network, we remain as busy as ever, with a full slate of podcasts scheduled for the fall. In the coming weeks, we'll be launching two new shows with new hosts, creating even more content for our members. Members receive an ad-free listening experience, an evening newsletter, an invitation to join the DSR Slack community, bonus content, and more. Best of all, if you become a member in the month of September, you'll receive 20% off the normal membership price. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and enter code SCHOOL at checkout. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code SCHOOL. Thank you for your support.
9, 12, 10, 28, 2, 23.
This is Deep State Radio, coming to you direct from our super secret studio in the third sub-basement of the Ministry of Snark in Washington, D.C., and from other undisclosed locations across America and around the world.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. This is a new weekly podcast from DSR. Every week we're going to have a discussion here looking at issues associated with national security and tech, ranging from nukes to AI to who knows what. Fortunately, because I don't know what, we have some people here who do, and one of them is our co-host for this show on an ongoing basis, John Wolstall. You've met John before here on this podcast. You probably heard John on many other platforms. He's one of our country's leading arms control and nuclear weapons specialists, and he was senior director for arms control and nonproliferation on the Obama NSC for that, and a lot of work in think tanks and some writing. He was also a special advisor to Vice President Joe Biden on national security and nonproliferation. And relevant to this discussion, he's spent some considerable time on the ground in North Korea. In fact, there are probably only a handful of Americans who've spent as much time on the ground in North Korea as John, and most of them are defectors. So welcome, John. How are you?
Thanks, David. I'm really happy to be here. I appreciate the chance to work with you.
Yeah, no, I think we'll have a great time. Another friend from past podcasts who is joining us is Andrea Kendall Taylor, who is a senior fellow and director of the Transatlantic Security Program at the Center for New American Security, CNAS, and adjunct professor at Georgetown University. Prior to joining CNAS, she served for 8 years as senior intelligence officer and as deputy national intelligence officer for Russia and Eurasia at the National Intelligence Council in the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. How are you, Andrea?
I'm great. Can't claim to ever having been to North Korea, but happy to be here.
Yeah, I don't think we'll probably get into this in a little more detail. I don't think that's a real gap in your travel background. we are also delighted to have with us Ambassador Mark Lippert. He served as the U.S. Ambassador to the Republic of Korea in Seoul from 2014 to 2017. He's an adjunct senior advisor at CSIS and is vice chairman of the board of directors at the Halifax International Security Forum. He previously served as chief of staff to Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel, and then as Assistant Secretary of Defense for Asia and Pacific Security Issues. I think that's back when I first met Mark. How are you doing, Mark?
Great. Thanks, David. Great to be here. And all those jobs underscore my mother's admonition that I just can't hold a position for any duration of time. So.
I think you've done just fine. And if you want us to talk to any of your relatives about that, we're happy. We are happy to do so. There are a couple of issues that we want to talk about today, as you can gather from us bringing together Mark and Andrea for this. Some of them have to do with an upcoming meeting between the leaders of North Korea and Russia. Others have to do with North Korea. Others have to do with Russia. But Why don't we start by letting John kick off the questioning?
Well, great, David. When you and I first got together and was talking about the podcast, I jokingly said I wanted to call it "Are We All Going to Die Radio?" And you said, "No, everybody already knows the answer to that question. It's just a matter of when." But when I saw the reports that Kim Jong-un and Vladimir Putin were getting together, it made me think maybe "Are We All Going to Die Radio?" is a good moniker, right?
Got that podcast edge to it. And we can embrace the name. If people who are listening want us to call this "Are We All Going to Die Radio?", just, you know, text us or tweet at us, and we can make that dream come true, John.
Just send $3 into our PO box address.
Exactly. Right?
There's an old joke that I feel about Russia and North Korea getting together the way I feel about Martin Lewis movies. I didn't really love any of their past work, and I'm not really looking forward to any of their future collaborations. But, you know, this is one of those things where it is out of the Cold War playbook, right? The Soviet Union and North Korea were very close. They had a symbiotic relationship. And for 35 years, they basically haven't done much together. North Korea didn't have much to offer Russia and vice versa. So when I saw these stories, I really wanted to talk to Andrea because you know more about Russia than anybody I know. And I want to talk to Mark because not only have you looked at North Korea from just below the 38th parallel, but you also understand the broader dynamics. And so I wanted to ask each of you, why do these guys want to get together? And I want to start with Andrea. Like, why does Vladimir Putin want to invite Kim Jong-un to come to Russia? Why now? And what's he going to get out of this?
Well, I mean, it's the same reason that he's kind of delving and diving into relations with China and Iran. And I think like the short answer is because he doesn't have a whole lot of other options. And given what's going on in Ukraine, the degradation of the Russian military in particular, I think he's fairly desperate to find alternative sources, particularly ammunition. That seems to be kind of the primary thing he's looking to most immediately from the North Koreans. But really, I mean, as you said, they haven't done since the Cold War era, they haven't had a lot of occasion for particularly deep cooperation. But as we're seeing kind of the shifting geopolitics, I think the growing the threat that both of them perceive, along with the Chinese and the Iranians, are pushing all of these actors together. I think as a little bit of a hardening authoritarian axis, and we can debate about, you know, actually how significant the coming together of all of these actors actually is. But to your point, though, you know, I don't know how much Russia really stands to gain from the relationship. I mean, there's not a whole lot that North Korea offers. Of course, they have these old stockpiles of ammunition and artillery and other things that they can use most immediately. But to me, that seems kind of it. I'm more interested in the other side of the equation, because the thing I think is most concerning is, you know, the more desperate that Russia gets, the more willing it's going to be to give stuff away. And I know North Korea is interested in missile technology and other things that it hasn't been able to access because of sanctions. And so that's what I worry about, is not so much how does this help Russia in Ukraine, but how is this war amplifying or leading Russia to amplify other threats and challenges that the United States faces in other places, North Korea, China, and Iran in particular?
Interesting. It dawned on me as we were getting ready for the podcast that, you know, the United States has been looking for shells to give to Ukraine. We actually asked the South Koreans to give us some of their stockpile of shells. And now we see the Russians going to ask the North Koreans for shells. And so
ammunition is the big thing for both sides.
But the tools that we were gearing up to blow each other up in the Korean Peninsula now are just going to be blowing up parts of Russia and Ukraine. So, you know, things spread. Mark, how are both the South Koreans going to look at this, right? The problem to the North just got a lot worse. And based on what you understand about the North Koreans, like, what are they hoping to get out of this?
Sure. Thanks, John. Great question and great to be here again. Let me take the second part first. I think the North stands to gain a considerable amount. First, remember, this is a country that's slowly re-emerging from COVID, right? Still, Kim Jong-un has not traveled. The country's essentially been on lockdown. And the last real significant memorable international engagement was Hanoi, which was a complete disaster for Kim Jong-un. So he gets a leader-level meeting out of Vladimir Putin that essentially puts him on the path to rehabilitation in the international sphere and also among his own people. Second thing, there's always a China angle with the North Koreans. And, you know, the Chinese or the North Koreans do not want to be overly dependent on the Chinese. They lost that avenue of the Americans after President Trump in Hanoi. This is a way to, again, put a little pressure and try to play the two sides off of each other. I don't think that's going on immediately, but I think, you know, it's right out of his grandfather's playbook, especially, who did it very adroitly. And then I'd say third, and it was alluded to already, right? I think the missile, any help on nuclear weapons, the advanced military technology, one area that I'm watching actually closely, the North Koreans are pretty proficient on, but could get some help that wouldn't cost the Russians a whole lot, is in special operations capabilities, right? And that's always been deeply concerning in and around the peninsula. So finally, any help on economics in terms of trade, hard currency, all of that, especially because, and the Post had a really good article about this that mentioned it, I do think Kim Jong-un used COVID to retrench, demolished a lot of these market mechanisms, informal market mechanisms that brought hard currency in, were coping mechanisms for the regime. But they also undermined control. Kim Jong-un struck against them, retrenched, but they are very, very short on cash from a country that's historically already short on cash. Second part of the question, what are the South Koreans thinking about this? Look, I do think that they are concerned, first point. Second, anything that would advance nuclear missile programs, I think, is being acutely watched, not just by the foreign policy elites in Korea now, but also, I think, among the general population. We saw this in play itself out in the Washington Declaration in terms of the South Koreans' desire to get more deeply involved in nuclear weapons. And let me just get off the stage by saying, anytime you have the North Koreans with more avenues at the Security Council, anytime you have a more hostile relationship between the United States, Russia, and blowing back on the South Koreans, that causes stress and concern among the opinion leaders and the policymakers in Seoul. Let me stop there. Thanks.
Thanks. Let me follow up on both of those answers a little bit. I think, Andrea, one of the things that one takes away from this is that this is point of leverage for Kim Jong-un, but it's also a point of weakness for Vladimir Putin. If at one point, a couple of years ago, people were like, this is one of the world's great military powers. Now, the Chinese aren't helping them in the way that they want to be helped. In fact, not many people are helping them. You've got the Iranians and, you've got Elon Musk, of course. He seems to be helping them as much as he possibly can. And then you've got the North Koreans. And maybe they get some electronic parts from the UAE. In other words, they're not, strong. We talk about this a lot in terms of what it means in terms of Ukraine. But I just wonder if you can sort of briefly frame this in terms of what do you think it means in terms of how we view Russia post-Ukraine or beyond Ukraine?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I know it is a sign of weakness. It is a signal of desperation. But I think, and it feels good to say that. We all like to say that Russia's weak, that Russia's desperate. But it also speaks to Russia's ability or its intent to adapt to the challenges that it's facing. So yes, we have these unprecedented sanctions on the Russians, and they are now actively engaging in opportunities to try to dilute that pressure, work around the sanctions. So it's not just the North Koreans, it's also the Iranians. Like you said, the UAE, they're putting pressure on countries in the Commonwealth of Independent States, the CIS, to try to get parts and components in. So I think we have to be mindful that, yes, Russia's down. It's definitely weaker as a result of the invasion of its neighbor, but it's not out. And they will still retain enough capacity for now, and certainly the intent to challenge the West. And so, that's my bumper sticker for Russia: down but not out.
Well, that's a disconcerting bumper sticker. In the case of North Korea, Mark, there have been other stories recently. The North Koreans have tried to stay in the center of of attention with a various announcement. Most recently, the announcement that they have they're launching a new kind or upgraded nuclear weapons capable submarine. I think there's some skepticism about the capabilities of the submarine. Not least of which, by the way, as far as I could tell from the articles that I've read, because it's named after a Korean war hero who was involved in an incident that never really took place, which is a telltale sign about how they do these things. Do you worry that they will get a little more adventurous and provocative post this kind of a meeting, and perhaps do so in part to draw attention away from what's going on in Ukraine?
Yeah, really good question. I would say a couple of things in response, maybe a little broader. First, the data points that you referenced are part of a relentless strategic trend over the past 20 years, you can argue, going back further, you can debate, to upgrade nuclear weapons and missile programs and enshrine them in their own constitution and basically say, we are here as a nuclear power and you have to negotiate with us, one. Two, I think, to your point about being more adventurous, I do think that the stronger they are with those core technologies, and if you layer on conventional weapons technologies, and maybe you pick up some from Russia, number one. Number two, maybe there's some hard currency that comes in that allows them to fulfill long needed modernization. There's no doubt that they're interested in a more coercive posture, especially in and around Seoul, right? Coerce Seoul through basically its artillery stockpiles in and around the Kaesong Heights, try to isolate the United States, break the alliance. I think that is all a well-established part of their playbook. And I think the tactical nuclear weapons piece, and you can argue, and I'd be interested in John's views here, the second strike capability that they're leading towards is all part of that broader playbook. So I do think, and I do worry, let's say, I don't necessarily think at this point that they're ready to be adventurous. I think they're still coming out of COVID, testing the boundaries, but they're putting the pieces back together, augmenting their capabilities to give them that ability to resume the coercive strategy that has long been part of their thinking and doctrine.
And the other thing that Russia will do is give the top cover in the UNSC, right? So that they now can get more political cover from UNSC condemnations for missile testing or anything else that they can do. So there's also kind of the political top cover element to it that can embolden the behavior.
What's more threatening to U.S. national security at the moment, the veto structure within the U.N. Security Council or the veto structure within the U.S. Senate? Anyway, I'm sorry to have interrupted you there, Mark.
Well, it's
really foreign policy podcast.
It's timely, apropos. The one thing you didn't mention in my background is I was a Senate staffer for 10 years. So,
I was just going to say, if somebody respects the right of the veto, it's going to be Mark.
What I was just going to make the point on the Security Council being hopelessly divided, undoubtedly plays into the North Korean strategy. And really basically signals to the regime that there is really almost no consequence. I think the question will be nuclear test, right? Because that does challenge the red lines of Moscow and Beijing. And would that, and I think it's one of the reasons the North Koreans have stayed away from that writ large at this point, or by and large at this point, rather. Thanks.
John, before I turn to you with questions, maybe we can in a future episode do who's more dangerous for the United States, Kim Jong-un or Tommy Tuberville? anyway, go ahead with your question.
Well, I was just going to say that this is really great. I mean, if I want to find out what's going on in these countries, I want to talk to Mark and Andrea, so I appreciate the discussion. A couple of things I'd add. I mean, one, it strikes me people and countries don't change, right? I mean, Vladimir Putin is pulling a page out of the old Soviet playbook. Let's divide and conquer the Western alliance. Let's splinter them. We'll threaten some. We'll cajole others. And Kim Jong-un is falling back on the old strategies of, okay, let's play Russia and China off each other. I want a coercive policy. I want to drive the South Korean, you know, I want to drive the U.S. off the South Korean peninsula so I can dominate. The tactics might change, but they tend to fall to type. And I think, you know, that's like the old expression, history doesn't repeat itself, but it sure rhymes. You know, we're seeing a lot of this play out. Two things I thought might have been missed. One is, look, Russia doesn't have a lot of cash to throw around to the North Koreans, but what they do have is a lot of oil and gas that they can give to the North Koreans, and that's going to free up resources. And the other thing they have is a really good criminal banking network that the North Koreans might like to really make use of. And so I think there's some compatibility there that makes a lot of sense.
Although I would just interject here that another story of the past week was the North Korean successful theft from a crypto outfit of $40-odd million. So they've got their own criminal capacity.
They're good. I mean, I think they actually, there's a lot to learn from each other, and it should worry. I'm sure justice is going to be spending a lot of time trying to figure out these tales. The idea that the North Koreans are going to get a lot more access to missile technology, space technology, nuclear capabilities that the Russians might be willing to share because they are desperate, I think really is going to have big ripple effects in East Asia. And, you know, I'm the nuclear geek on the call, so I always want to go right towards, you know, what does this mean for my nuclear nightmares? But it's not making me sleep any better here. And one of the things that we have said for a long time that's holding the North Koreans back is they haven't tested warheads on missiles to make sure that they're reliable and will work over distance. And the Russians have done that a lot. And so that's one of the areas that I'm really looking at. Now, last thing, and then I'll turn things back over to David, is the submarine that the North Koreans have just announced. You know, they really like to push themselves out as this modern, cutting-edge, nuclear-capable country. And they are doing some things much better than we thought. But we should keep in mind that this is a 1950s-era Soviet submarine that they cut in half and then put in some missile silos and then glued it back together. And U.S. submarines, even Russian submarines and increasingly Chinese submarines are pretty secure. They're hard to find. This is going to be one of the loudest submarines in the ocean. So they're either going to, you know, put it around outside the Simpo port, which we can find pretty easily, or it'll go down and probably won't come back up again. It doesn't mean that they won't learn a lot, and in the future, they might be able to do better. And that's another area that I think the Russians are probably more than willing to help them at, if they can get a few million artillery shells to keep bombing Ukrainian cities.
Yeah, the submarine quieting is something they have to offer both the North Koreans, also the Chinese. But the one point I wanted to make, John, on your fears is, you know, the thing I am mindful of, concerned about in the wake of Russia's invasion of Ukraine is that they may be less committed to nonproliferation. And, you know, you think about North Korea, Iran, Russia, they've been a big proponent supporter of nonproliferation, but more because I think it contributes to their geopolitical status in the world. I think that they've always perceived that they get these geopolitical advantages from doing so. And that's been the incentive much more than it has been because they're actually concerned about security risks of North Korea or Iran gaining nuclear weapons. I don't think Moscow perceives that those weapons actually threaten Moscow. And so now, as kind of they're unleashed and they are an international pariah, I think it's likely that they're not going to perceive those same geopolitical advantages anymore. And so I think it just feeds your fears. I think they will be less committed to nonproliferation now.
I think that's true. I mean, norms don't matter to Putin, and he's shown that. What really is remarkable is, you know, having traveled to Russia over the years, it's hard to find people that were more dismissive of the Iranians' intellectual capability or the North Koreans' intellectual capability than the Russians, right? They didn't believe that Iran was building a nuclear weapon because they didn't think they were capable. They thought the same thing. And the fact now that Putin has to go begging the Iranians for drones and the North Koreans for artillery shells, you're right, Andre, it feels good, but it should be worrisome. But you know it burns Putin to have to stoop down because he feels he's really lowering himself. And it just shows how desperate I think they are. And that should also worry us, right? They may be down, but not out. You wrote a foreign affairs article about that, I think. And it's true, right? Just because they're weaker doesn't mean that they're not dangerous.
Yeah. And by the way, I don't think it makes them feel much better that, they're victims of attacks by cardboard Australian drones. that they can't seem to stop. Maybe we'll come to that in a moment. Mark, I can't help but ask you in the context of this discussion, how does the recent summit between the U.S., South Korea, and the Japanese play into this? Because it does seem like we're entering a new phase of that relationship. A lot of the context for, you know, the coverage of it had to do with China. Finally, these two sides coming together over China. Clearly, North Korea and to some extent Russia must figure in it as well.
Yeah, really interesting question. And I would say, let me start by saying, you know, we've always seen, especially with conservative governments in South Korea, reasonable amounts of trilateral cooperation. So it's, I think, the jury's still out about, I think, the permanency of this new era, so to speak, because the progressives will have something to say about this. And last time around, when the progressives came into office, they went after the Comfort Women Agreement. They ended up endorsing it, ironically, on the way out the door after 5 years. But there was a lot more scratchiness in the relationship. So I think we'll see. I think what I would say on this in terms of Japan, China, all of that, I do think the Chinese are a driving factor in terms of closer cooperation. I think it does help get the two sides together, the three sides rather, starting with Seoul and Tokyo together on a more frequent basis and a more serious basis. There's no doubt about that. They have always worked together on North Korea. I think especially after some of the mistrust in the 90s about whether or not the Japanese were going to cut their own deal with the North Koreans. The South Koreans in the 90s were not allowed in the room when the U.S. was talking at some point. So that era is over. On that. And I do think the North Korea issue for the last 10 to 15 years has been one area where they all do work together well. The Russia question is very interesting. I mean, everybody remembers the forays Mr. Abe made about the Northern Territories, with whatever the proper political term is there. And that era also is over too. So I think generally speaking, what you're seeing is an alignment of South Korea, Japan, the U.S. I do think across the board on all three, there is a lot of commonality in how they view those different actors. I think there's much less disparity in terms of different entreaties or individual entreaties between capitals unilaterally. And I think there's just going to be tight coordination going forward. Even with the progressives, I do think the progressives will come in and generally embrace this. As I said, on their way out the door, they basically embraced the deals of the previous administration in Korea. So I do think going forward, this is going to be a significant development and an important geopolitical milestone in the region.
Well, I want to follow up on that and the rest of the discussion. In the spirit of John's cheery, "We're all going to die" radio, because I think as this show goes on, each and every week we have to look at something apocalyptic, and I want to do that. But this is the point.
David, we are going to send free Zoloft to all the listeners. So,
well, low priced, it's an interesting idea, by the way, is kind of swag. We used to do mugs, you know, but maybe now
just drug your listeners. We should just a good way to keep them coming back for more.
DSR branded Zoloft, but we'll do it in a minute. This is the point in the show where we say to all of you who are in the general public listening, thanks for listening. And if you want to listen to the whole show, if you want to listen to all the bonus content on all the shows we've got, then the way to do that is to become a member. Go to thedsrnetwork.com, click on membership. I think it's about, $5 a month, and it's well worth it. You can tell because this conversation is good and it's going to get better right after this break. For those of you in the general public, see you soon. For those of you who are members, stand by.